This episode of the Daily Brief Podcast is presented by Tiny Hero. No matter your story or genre, we've got bold vision, fresh ideas, and unconventional creative. Just when you need us, we'll be your hero. Hello, I'm Paige Albiniak, Editorial Director of Promax BDA. Today's episode of the Daily Brief Podcast addresses the ever-present issue of fake news. It's a term we hadn't even really heard before the 2016 presidential campaign, and now it's something we discuss nearly every day. In this episode taken from Promax BDA's June conference, Dylan Byers, senior media reporter for CNN, Sarah Fisher, media reporter at Axios, and Sasha Isenberg, Washington correspondent for Monocle, discuss this potentially fraught intersection of news and marketing, particularly as it exists online. What news and media organizations do marketers want to have their brands associated with? How can brands safely make that determination? And what should marketers do if they find themselves associated with a brand that's under fire? Let's listen in on what this panel has to say.
Hello, everybody. How are y'all doing? Thank you so much for coming out. We're going to try and have an extremely lively and fruitful discussion about not just truth, lies, and news, but about what it means for marketers and what it means for marketing and where those two worlds intersect. And I actually think they intersect more so than I even knew going into today. So I want to introduce our two guests. First, we have Sarah Fisher, who covers the business of media and marketing for Axios. Thank you. Hello. And then secondly, we have Sasha Isenberg, who is a phenomenal writer, has written for Monocle, Bloomberg Politics, also the author of several books, including The Victory Lab, about the science of political campaigning, and my favorite book, The Sushi Economy, which I cannot recommend highly enough. So, if you are in the world of media and politics, and you cover the sort of media industry from that vantage point, write about predating the rise of Donald Trump, but certainly a hell of a lot since then, we've been having a conversation about how media became so partisan, so bifurcated, how we got to a point where someone walked into a pizza shop in Washington, D.C. with a semi-automatic rifle because he thought that there was a sex ring, child sex ring, being run by Hillary Clinton there. Why it is that some people believe everything Sean Hannity says, whereas many other people doubt everything that Sean Hannity says. Why there are MSNBC people and Fox News people. Why some people won't even listen to an argument that's made in the New York Times because it comes from the New York Times and because it's been dubbed fake news. So, where does that intersect with marketing? Well, what that is about is really a question about where can you go to have an experience that you trust. And as a marketer and as a brand, especially if you're thinking about advertising in the space of news media, who do you want to be associated with? What organizations do you want to have your brand associated with? What is the user experience like? User experience is not just, you know, is an ad inundating you with autoplay videos and pop-up ads. It's also about, is this actually a reputable place where people want to live? Is it, from the news consumption point of view, is it a sexy place to be as a user? And secondly, given the fraught news environment that we live in, where everybody and every brand seems to be one step away from controversy, one errant tweet or remark away from basically having a boycott launched against them, how do you associate yourself with good brands, and what do you do if the brands that you associate with come under fire? So we're going to start the conversation there. Both Sarah and Sasha have been thinking about these things, and I'm sure we'll have many salient points to make on them. But I think the first conversation is, or the first question here is to just sort of get a lay of the land, which is, where are we now in terms of the landscape of news, and where are we in terms of who, how did things become so bifurcated, and what are the implications for marketers?
So I think, I mean, the first thing is understanding how bifurcated our political culture has become. I mean, that's a sort of template on which I think everybody is operating, especially media companies. And we've known for a long time, I mean, political scientists have been studying going back into the 1940s, the extent to which sort of our political parties are like clubs or tribes that you know, voters, citizens fall into, and stick with them. You know, I think our idea that everybody is on an individual level making a whole bunch of rational decisions every day about who to vote for, or which party to be part of, or what media to consume, has never really been the case. But what's happened, we know, in the last 30 or so years is that, you know, two big dynamics are sort of, you know, two political sides have become a lot more sorted. People who identify as Democrats now have a lot more in common demographically, ideologically. You know, we're talking socioeconomic status, education levels, race, gender, marital status. And then our parties have become more polarized. They actually just disagree on more things. And some of that's what people call negative polarization, which is to say that being a Democrat often means just disagreeing with what a Republican position on something is. You know, the healthcare debate is a good example of this. You know, particular policy positions are now, you know, that were broadly embraced by Republicans 10 years ago now are anathema because they have Obama's name on them, and vice versa. You know, you look at something like the debate over NATO, people a year ago who, you know, were skeptical of NATO because they are sort of dovish leftists now are great protectors of NATO because Donald Trump is on the other side of the debate. And media organizations, I think, have become aware that their audiences are fragmented in this very polarized way. The one thing that's unusual just in the last 6 months, it's not part of these broader trends, is that we have a president who is overtly saying about media organizations and other brands which team they're on. And I think before that was a set of signals that were often unclear or hazy. You know, it was a big deal when Dick Cheney was heard on microphone calling a reporter from the New York Times a major league a-hole. Now Donald Trump basically says that every day. And so the signals are really overt about which companies belong on which side. And I think that, you know, that is something that it's a lot harder for companies to sort of try to keep some ambiguity between these two teams, saying that we sort of serve both their interests.
Right, and in the since Trump became president, even during the campaign, I would say any brand is moments away from having the president of the United States tweet at you and affect your brand in what can be very serious ways. And because of the digital environment we live in, because of the sort of social media campaigns that go on around a brand sort of political relationship or political relationship with the president of the United States in this case, that affects things too. How is that, Sarah, how do brands cope with that in the digital age, and how do they prepare for that in the digital age?
It's something that when I speak with brands, it's usually their first question for me, and they'll say, you know, it used to be that if a president or someone from the administration called us out, it was likely for something that we, you know, violated some sort of regulation, that we outwardly did something wrong. Whereas in this climate, it could actually be that you're just not liked for something that you're doing, or that it's politically advantageous for the president or for someone else to target your brand because it benefits them in the short term. And so how do you handle that? Well, again, it used to be that you had more time. Like the 24-hour news cycle has created a situation in which no brand can wait more than a few hours to respond. And your traditional response, a press release, an op-ed in a national paper, probably won't cut it. The amount of people that the president is going to reach in a tweet is nowhere near the amount of people that you can combat that message with in a national paper print ad or just on your website's press release. You now have to come back with an amplified message, whether it be on Twitter, whether it be through a social media influencer or on Facebook, and you need to tailor your campaign that way. And I think for brands, especially big ones, who their marketing department might be in Chicago, but they're headquartered in Boston, but their ad agency's in New York, this can be incredibly challenging. How do you rally everybody that is instrumental to making the decision about how you respond within minutes? And so we see brands in Washington particularly, this is a huge trend, hiring crisis communication firms to come in and be working alongside their communication team. And no longer is it marketing communication, it's become communications marketing. It's become a rapid response crisis comms environment for almost every brand so that you can be ready to respond if something happens.
Right. The crisis communications aspect of it to me seems like you would not think as a brand outside of the sort of political fray that you would necessarily need a crisis communications team. And yet, it seems apparent to me now, just because of the political landscape that we're living in, that everybody needs a crisis.
But the other thing is, when you have such polarization, right, good news becomes bad news for the other side. So you take the example of something, you know, there was going back a few months, one of the first domestic trips that Trump was going to make from the White House was to go to Wisconsin to visit, I believe, a Harley-Davidson factory. Now, Harley-Davidson has a fairly defined brand image as an American heritage brand. This was the President of the United States going to do a generic pro-manufacturing trip. I think in any other media or political environment, that would have been seen as a net plus for a major company. The Chamber of Commerce would have been excited about it. Local politicians of both parties probably would have come. Everybody would have seen it. It's a good local news hit. It's a national exposure. And all of a sudden, by dint of somebody who is as complicated as Donald Trump coming, the company had to deal with this as though it's a crisis. The president wants to do a photo op at your factory, and you're concerned about whether that's going to be a bad news cycle because now you're identified with something that you know, half the country is opposed to. And not knowing how he's going to talk about your company, right? He gets really possessive about, like, Carrier as though it's, like, you know, an adjunct of the Trump Organization. You know, he had this weird love-hate relationship with Boeing and other major federal contractors. And so you get pulled into a world where what seems good all of a sudden risks antagonizing a significant portion of your base. And, you know, the fake news part of it is that people are conditioned now to believe what their side is telling them about what the truth is. And I think that that's a real novel danger. Like, you know, that it's not clear what a good news cycle is in anything related to the public sphere now for a company, because almost invariably you end up part of a tribal battle that you didn't start.
That's a really important, like, there are multiple news cycles. There was a sort of, the idea of a common narrative is dead because different people are living different narratives. And so that's obviously something marketers have to concern themselves with. The other thing is, it's not just the battle you'll get from partisan sides in the media. The other issue is the rise of bots, which aren't even real people, but just by their being programmed to take down anyone can do significant damage to your brand. When we were having lunch, Sarah told me an amazing statistic which blew my mind, which is what
50% of the internet is bots.
50% of the internet is bots. So if you, let's take a situation like, which is one Sasha brought up over lunch, which is what happened with Uber and Lyft when there was the taxi strike in New York. Well, okay, so first of all, you got enough pressure to deal with from human beings, but on top of that, if you have bots programmed against you, is there, when you talk to people, is there anything that people are doing to, like, take on the sort of non-human aspect of social media pressure?
Yeah, a lot of people are trying to figure out the best thing that you can do. I mean, the way that it affects fake news, just so that everybody is on the same page, is that bots are programmed to amplify messaging. So a bot can be programmed to retweet a specific tweet from a conservative outlet, or to comment and like something on Facebook from a particular outlet that has a partisan lean. And a lot of groups would argue that the prevalence of fake news on Facebook during the election came from bot-filtered accounts that were pushing and promoting fake news to elevate it in the newsfeed, which is why it had more exposure than perhaps any other type of regular organic story. A lot of people say bots are more prevalent on social media platforms, which is true. How do you combat that, though? Like, how do you get rid of them? I mean, there's a lot of different things that you can do. Some argue that if you force social media companies to have two-step authentication, and so forcing whoever's signing in to check on their mobile phone to be able to sign in, you would have essentially a way of filtering out who's human and who's not, who has a cell phone number, or you know, who can tap a cell phone and who's not. The problem is, You don't want, if you're a social media platform, if you're Twitter or if you're Facebook, you don't want to negate the amount of engagement or reduce the amount of engagement that you could possibly get from people, because you're a data-driven company. You make your money off of engagement and having full accessibility to everybody. And so it's a catch-22. And a huge part of fake news is manufactured fake news, is, as Dylan said, it's the prevalence of bots. It's tricking and scamming algorithms. It's tricking and scamming websites. The amount of fake news sites during this election that were made and programmed to look like the New York Times, but they weren't, or made to program and look like CNN video, but they weren't actually, was a large part of what fake news looked like this past election. And that's a large part of what, as Sasha was explaining, drove this partisan wedge to a point that we've never seen before, ever really in our history.
And do you get the impression in recent days, a few significant things have happened in recent days. One, Apple announced yesterday that they're going to block autoplay videos. And Apple accounts for, is it 10% of
Safari?
Search? And Google has said that it is going to introduce an ad blocker. What does that mean for publishers? What does it mean for advertisers?
So a really important thing that I'm sure most of you have heard of is this concept called the duopoly, which is Google and Facebook owning the majority of ad revenue and traffic in our digital ecosystem. The duopoly is really eating at true news, in the sense that economically it's making it very hard for websites and publishers to survive. To give you a sense, the advertising watchdog, if you will, calculated that Google and Facebook will take 90% of every new ad dollar this year, which means that every other publisher, CNN.com, Monocle, Axios, New York Times, is fighting for that last 10%. How do they make their money? Most of them make it on advertising. Most of them are trying to monetize digital ads. Well, you can imagine how hard it is to monetize digital ads when Google and Facebook are eating at the market. And this past 2 weeks, when Apple Safari and Google's Chrome both announced ad blocking techniques or features would be added to their technology, how terrifying that is for publishers, in the sense that it's a great effort on both of those companies' end to make this environment really suitable and really great for consumers. Who likes like pesky banner ads? It can be very annoying, those pop-ups. But from a publisher's perspective, if you don't adhere to the guidelines that a third party has set, your website is going to be blocked from those two search engines, which control about 60% of traffic on desktop and about 68% of traffic on mobile. Means you won't be able to monetize. And a lot of people will say, okay, well, that's only like pesky websites, right? That's only like, you know, crappy commercialization websites. That's not true. The majority of websites in our environment, like high profile news websites, don't adhere necessarily to those guidelines yet. So we're looking at a real threat to publishers, potentially, if they're not able to sort of beef up their websites in time, to have access to consumers if, you know, these ad blocking technologies come to fruition and they're not ready for them.
Right.
And I think the other, you know, part of it in terms of trying to control the consumer reader experience on some of these large digital platforms, especially social, is, you know, the sort of curation challenge, right? So we, shortly after Election Day, when I think the term of fake news came into circulation, people became aware of the possible scale of that before Election Day. Mark Zuckerberg sent a letter and eventually sort of suggested that they were going to look into, thought that they had a problem with what I think he quantified was 2% of the news on their site. And we've seen moves since then. Campbell Brown going to Facebook to be like a head of news type, Lauren Kern, formerly of New York Magazine, going to Apple to be some sort of editorial person. But, you know, I think once again, any effort to try to create either through, in an automated machine learning way, efforts to identify suspicious fake news or use human beings to do it on an individual level. I mean, there are obviously huge challenges of scale to do that with a room of human editors. But we saw a year ago with something as simple as Facebook trying to introduce that trending topics thing that everything is going to be seen through a partisan lens. I mean, you know, pick a piece of coverage about Donald Trump that's on any news site today, in any newspaper, a segment on any TV show, and probably your instinct will be that's either positive or negative. And basically upvoting it or downvoting it, blackballing it as fake news will be seen as by a significant amount of readership or viewership as taking a partisan, you know, casting a partisan vote on whether that's good news in a quality sense. And so I think it's really risky in this environment for, and I think social media companies recognize this, to even take that first step towards saying that fake news is their problem. And it ultimately, there's revenue on the table to figure out the sort of user experience in an ad blocking way, but there are huge reputational challenges to avoid being pulled into the sort of tribal aspects of American politics, making, for these companies to make news judgments, you know, all of whom are concerned in Washington about their lobbying interests, their public policy interests, selling advertising to the same politicians that are being covered in news stories. And so this is one of the big questions for tech companies is, you know, do they want to be news organizations and can they deal with the political criticism that will inevitably ensue?
So with the last 8 minutes that we have, take that, and then what happens when you're aligned with a brand, you're marketing in a certain environment, everything's going well, and then all of a sudden the proverbial ass hits the fan and you've got a crisis on your hands where you're now associated with somebody who's been accused of sexual harassment and there's an advertiser boycott. You're associated with somebody who's been accused, you're sponsoring a show for somebody who's been accused or who said something inappropriate on air and there's public pressure. It seems to me that just the nature of how vitriolic social media is and how eager people are to tear other people down, that as a brand, is there any way to endure that? Or does the moment one advertiser flies away, does every advertiser fly away? I mean, do you just cut the cord immediately, or is there a more sort of nuanced strategy for dealing with crises like that?
Well, I think the point that you made about the amplification of sentiment, this exists in our ecosystem today more prevalently than it ever has. If you think about the way algorithms are programmed, like on Facebook, they're meant to cater to emotional responses. You can actually respond with a happy face or a sad face. And so you're completely right that we are now amplifying our reaction to certain news stories through emotion in a way that we've never been able to do so instantaneously. And if you're a brand, it used to be that if something like that happened, you could take a step back and say, well, what's my ROI? Do I still want to advertise on Hannity's show? I know that I'm getting all of my marketing metrics right. I know it's working. But is the branding too bad for me? Well, I might say that it's not because I'm getting what I need out of it. Nowadays, there are so many watchdogs on social media that are out to politicize every single scandal, you might not necessarily be able to make that calculus. For example, there's a Twitter account called Sleeping Giants that was developed last year. Anytime there's a scandal, anytime there's a website that they don't like, or that they think publishes fake news, if you're an advertiser on that site, they will publicly call you out, they will tweet at you, and they will say, we know you're running on Breitbart, for example, and we're gonna make sure all of your followers know it. This has created an environment in which it is like a domino effect. No longer is it one advertiser pulls and the next can kind of consider whether or not they do. We saw this with Bill O'Reilly. One day, one advertiser pulled, the next 57 were done.
And by the way, I forget where I saw this report, which, going to fake news, I might totally be citing an erroneous report. But I believe Breitbart has lost, the headline I saw was something like an astronomical, it was like 90% of advertising. And that, it's down 90% from a year ago, which to me is just an astronomical thing.
Building on what Sarah said, right? And the metrics, I think one of the perils of being a data-driven organization, whether you're a marketer or you're a producer, is that different types of metrics will come to you with different lags and different sort of aura of certainty or precision to them. And the things that'll probably come back to you first are not the traditional ROI on marketing, which will probably have something to do with sales or referrals, but will be things that are basically reputational, and a lot of that'll be emotional and negative coming back to you. And so if there is this cascade effect taking place with advertisers, almost invariably the first feedback you get is going to be negative and not connected to actual sales. It's going to be negative connected to sentiment. And so, you know, it's probably incumbent on intelligent marketers to define before there's a crisis engulfing a personality or a news organization with on which they advertise or somebody with whom they have a partnership or a sponsorship agreement, what actually is success or failure for us? Because I think it'll be very distracting if you first have that conversation in the context of we're on O'Reilly or we're on Hannity or we're on Breitbart or whatever it may be.
So just, we got 3 minutes left. Do you, one tension that I've always found with the user experience as a news consumer, but also just and the digital experience generally, is the sites that are most comfortable to live at are sites that offer authoritative journalism, but are also very well designed and aren't inundating you with content that you're not looking for, namely advertising you're not looking for. Obviously, that's a huge challenge for advertisers. Let's do the five-year prospectus. Are we headed for an internet that feels cleaner and more user-friendly, or are we headed for more advertising flying all over the map, popping up everywhere, making it almost impossible to...
Economically, we're heading towards the former. Absolutely.
Great.
So, yes, it's good news for everybody. So we've definitely hit a saturation point. If you talk to folks like Comscore, who measure digital engagement and digital metrics, they'll tell you we've reached peak app. We don't download apps anymore. The average person downloads 0 to 1 a month. When it comes to growth and percentage of growth, we're plateauing across every digital metric, whether it's video, Facebook engagement. Facebook told investors earlier this year, expect our ad revenue to come down because we've reached newsfeed saturation. And so what does that mean? It means that no longer are we in an environment where, as a publisher, you can monetize scale, because we are saturated. Instead, we are putting the monetization priority on the reader. And that's why you're seeing such an uptick in subscriptions. Because no longer are we trying to focus on making as much money from scaling our digital ads. It's either A, make more money, a higher CPM per ad, through a better and smarter ad, usually native, or B, transition your revenue stream to subscriptions. And you're seeing this happen dramatically within this year. Dramatically. The New York Times, for the first time in its history, has more subscription revenue than advertising revenue. And that's amazing. So it's a good thing for the reader. I would expect less pesky ads, especially because the tech giants are taking so many steps to make it that way. And hopefully, the digital ecosystem becomes less chaotic.
Mm-hmm. And then the challenge here, right, for advertisers is the less that you are buying programmatically against certain networks, certain personalities, certain programs, certain types of programming, the less, you know, if you are buying basically individually matched cookies or IP addresses or some sort of modeled universe of those, you're not buying something that can be boycotted. And yet you can be held publicly accountable for helping to subsidize a personality who's become toxic. And I think that puts advertisers, marketers in a sort of no-win situation, right? And I think we don't have activists will have more targets to go after and more of the illusion of accountability, but less actual accountability for the people who have leverage over the media organizations that they're advertising on.
Brilliant. We're out of time. Guys, thank you so much for coming. I hope we gave you something. Thanks a lot, and thank you to ProMax for having us. We appreciate it.
We would like to thank Tiny Hero for sponsoring this episode of the Daily Brief podcast. Tiny Hero, for theatrical, home entertainment, and broadcast campaigns. Trailers, social, TV spots, digital, and sizzles. Just when you need us, we'll be your hero. Check them out at tinyhero.com. Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. LaFern Cusack is executive producer of the Daily Brief podcast and senior producer at Promax BDA. Video helper provided the music. Digital producer Kate LaCaire-Marion and social media coordinator Christian Craik contribute to Daily Brief. Follow Paige on Twitter at Paige A. Follow LaFern at LaFern Cusack. Follow Promax BDA at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org. Subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.